Welcome to Reality TV, the podcast where we cringe watch all the shows we love and love to hate. I'm Jody, and I'll be your inner voice as I break down all the shows we watched together this week. No shame, no regret, just wanting all the reality we can get. Remember to check the show notes for how to find me and the rest of our chosen people. Facebook and Instagram, Welcome to Reality TV, and Twitter at Reality TV Pod. And for bonus episodes, head on over to patreon.com/welcometorealityTV. And now, on with the show. Hello, hello, welcome back. I hope you all had a fantastic Christmas and happiest of holidays, whatever it is you celebrate, everything, nothing, all of it combined like we do in our house since my son decided he wanted to be Jewish. We just kind of do it all here. So I hope you had all the best of it just like we had. Now I'm going to kind of mix it up this week since I don't have any shows to recap. But again, wait till January. Holy shit, do we have a lot to watch. But today I wanted to just be off the cuff. I don't have anything specific planned, a script to talk from, nothing. But I wanted to talk about some missing person, stolen identity, true crime cases that have just been eating at me for years. And one of them was just solved last year. And I probably gasped. I mean, it probably sounded like I just solved the crime myself when I heard that it was solved. I, like many of you, grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries and in the era of Polly Class. How could you forget that? One of my most distinctive memories in my mind was watching the made-for-TV movie of the Steven Stainer kidnapping. I know my first name is Steven. We also know Steven Stainer as the younger brother of Kerry Stainer, who went on to become an infamous murderer himself. And recently, obviously, the Maura Murray cases and the Tara Calico podcast. If you haven't listened to it, or if you remember this case, you might want to pop in because they have some new leads on this case. It's the case that I had talked about with Carrie from the Sip and Shine podcast. It was featured on Unsolved Mysteries. I mean, we're talking 80s. This is an old case. And it was a teenage girl who went missing after riding her bike. Someone pulled up to a white van in like a 7-Eleven parking lot. And when they came out, the van was gone, but they had found a photograph on the ground of a teenage girl and a young boy, and they were bound and gagged in the back of the van. Her family thinks that it's her. Some people have said that it's not. And when Carrie tipped me off, she was like, oh my God, this is that case that you were talking about. There's a podcast for it. I jumped on it. And man, the things that have gone on in the past year with that case are really mind-blowing. So in saying that, I wanted to jump into this case. And if any of you have been following it, we have got to talk. We'll start a new thread or I don't know, something. But this is the case of Lori Erica Ruff. L-O-R-I, Erica with a C, R-U-F-F. If you want to go and look up her photo, because that is the thing that just drew me in when I first saw this case, oh my gosh, years and years ago, maybe, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. It's really fascinating. There are massive, deep threads on Reddit. Sleuths who have spent thousands of hours of their own time comparing her photo to missing person photos, to unsolved cases, to, it sounds really creepy, but like corpses where they're Jane Doe's. And you need to know going right off the bat, this is not a spoiler. Lori Erica Ruff committed suicide. And it leads to this discovery that she had a hidden identity. And after years and years of dead ends, it was finally solved last year. So let's start at the beginning. In 2003, Lori met Blake Ruff at church in a Bible study class. Blake described her as being incredibly secretive and always avoided talking about her past. Hey guys, red flag. Now, the only information she did ever give him was that she was from Arizona, both her parents had died, her father was a stockbroker, and she was an only child. Now, of course, he's curious, but, oh, he's a fool in love, and he looks past it, and they elope and get married in January 2004, and the only person there was themselves and the preacher. Now, Lori and Blake then move to Leonard, Texas. She has a whole slew of fertility issues. She can't get pregnant. She has several miscarriages. And later on, investigators thought that maybe this infertility was due to Lori actually being older than what she had claimed. Turns out the difference of her actual identity and the age that she gave was only off by about a year. So it wasn't much of a lead. But for a while, that was something that they were hanging their hats on. She eventually gave birth to a baby girl through in vitro in 2008. She was extremely protective of her daughter. She wouldn't let anyone else hold her daughter, and it caused a ton of friction between her in-laws, Blake's family, and her. She would also, I thought this was so crazy, she would obsessively track the Ruff's family history. So her husband's side of the family, their ancestry and stuff. She would try to find out their family recipes, but yet she refused to talk about her own. She also would do really weird social things. And one of the things that would end up upsetting and annoying her in-laws was that she would leave family events to go and take naps. I'm just going to say, I know someone like that, and I can see where you kind of have that, like, oh, that's the family weirdo. What is he seeing her? Okay, I know it sounds terrible, but it's just the truth. Now, eventually, Lori did not want her in-laws to have anything to do with her daughter. She just blocked all contact. At this same time, Blake and Lori, oh, shocking surprise, they're having marital issues, so they're going to marriage therapy. But eventually, you know, it's the straw that breaks the camel's back. They break up. Blake moves back with his parents and files for divorce, but Lori stays with the daughter. Now, in the months between the separation and Lori's suicide, her behavior became increasingly erratic. One of her neighbors said that she saw Lori and the daughter, and their weight loss was extremely quick and dramatic, and they both looked very thin, malnourished, and Lori would just go off on these tangents. She would be rambling incoherently, and she also started sending these crazy emails to the Ruff family, and their harassment got so bad that they had to file a cease and desist order right before she committed suicide. Now, I've read so many people saying, why didn't the neighbor do anything to see a mother and a child lose a lot of weight and become thin because the daughter was still young? It's like, do you really want to be getting involved as a neighbor, especially if she seems like she's a little unhinged? I can see where you just want to stay out of it. Now, on December 24th, 2010, Lori's body was discovered in her car in the Ruff's driveway. She had shot and killed herself, and in the car with her were two suicide notes. One of them was an 11-page note written to, and she put on the front, "My wonderful husband." Again, remember, they were going through a pretty nasty divorce. The other note that she left was addressed to her daughter, and it had instructions on it not to be opened until her 18th birthday. Well, of course, like anyone, the Ruff family is going to open up that note and see what she's written to the daughter. I know I would. Okay, I'm nosy, I admit it. But all the note contained was just rambling, this is their quote, ramblings from a clearly disturbed person. And unfortunately, there was no details about her past, which is what they were hoping. So none of these notes even make sense to this day, even though they have found out her identity. So clearly there were some mental health issues going on. And unfortunately, I feel like at this time, this was 7 years ago, yes, we knew about mental health, but I don't think it is as widely accepted and understood as it is now, 7 years later. So maybe that's a good sign. Now, after Lori's funeral, some of Blake's family decided that they were going to drive to Lori's house and see if they could find any information hidden away somewhere in the house as to where she came from. The house was a complete mess. There were still dirty dishes piled everywhere, papers, things shredded, scribblings on them. Nothing made sense. You know, in my mind, I'm picturing a house from the Hoarders, you know. So then they found in the closet a lockbox. I mean, like, reading this just made my heart skip a beat because what I would give to be in there during that discovery. I'd probably be on here with you guys like, holy shit, oh my God, let's do this together. So they used a screwdriver to pry it open and they discovered the documentation of Lori's past. There was, get ready for this one, you guys, so good. They found a birth certificate for a Becky Sue Turner and a judge's ruling allowing someone who is presenting herself as Becky Sue to change her name legally to Lori Erica Kennedy. So after they did a little digging, the Ruffs found out that Becky Sue Turner had died in a house fire at the age of 2. Let that sink in for a second. So Lori had the birth certificate of a child who died in a house fire at 2 years old, Becky Sue Turner, went into court claiming she was Becky Sue Turner, changed her name to Lori Erica Kennedy. Okay. Now, for sake of time, there were a bunch of other materials, tons of scribbling over things with names and phone numbers and addresses, but all of those led to dead ends. It was, I mean, these things, if you go deep into Reddit, if they're still active, again, I don't know how Reddit works, but people went with these names and numbers and really dug into it. Nothing, still to this day. A year later, in 2011 now, an investigator for the Social Security Administration agreed to help identify her as a case of identity theft. So now they had something to work with. They had a crime that they could investigate. The investigator thought, okay, I may be able to crack this case pretty quickly. But after following tons of leads, even he was stumped. So then at that point, he said, okay, we're just going to go to the general public. We have fairly good current pictures of her. We're going to see if the public can help. So an article in the Seattle Times was written in 2013. And then that article, as many newspaper articles are, was just kind of pushed off and republished in hundreds of other newspapers. And that's where I had heard of the Lori Erica Ruff case, but it's kind of where the pedal to the metal went at that point, where most of these sleuths really started digging in. There were theories being that she was part of a Vegas crime family. Someone had mentioned that maybe she was in the witness protection program, and I kind of thought that that one might have been plausible for a while. Some people thought maybe she committed a crime or she went AWOL from the military. And there were quite a few photos of missing or dead people in databases that really did look like her. I thought that there was one of a high schooler, I'm forgetting the details now, because it was maybe a year or two ago that I really dug into it. And I really thought that it was her, but obviously I was wrong. So in 2013, a forensic genealogist began working on the case. Thank God for DNA. So they used a saliva sample from her daughter and they began matching the records of her DNA samples with, you know, different links that they had. Now it's at this point it kind of stalled out because it took years to establish a link. Everyone, go get your ancestry DNA because the more that go in there, the better it is. So they were able to take her DNA, trace it back to a great-great-grandfather from Ireland from a third cousin hit on DNA or from ancestry, wherever. So now this forensic genealogist took that great-great-grandfather from the third cousin, followed down all the different possible ancestry lines until she found a family in Pennsylvania. So the Social Security Administration, the SSA investigator, who is now retired at this point, flew to Pennsylvania to meet the potential family. They had no idea he was coming, had no idea who this guy was, and he showed up at their workplace. And he tried first explaining the whole concept of DNA and lineage and all that kind of stuff, but as anyone would, if someone showed up at my workplace and just started talking about DNA shit, I'd be like, okay. So as he said, as soon as they started kind of tuning him out, like, okay, what are you selling? He slapped down a photo of Lori Erica Ruff's driver's license, and the person said, oh my God, that's Kimberly. So after years, we find out that her real name was Kimberly McLean, and her uncle is kind of the family spokesperson because her mom is now well into her 80s, and he provided a little background on this situation. It seems like Kimberly / Lori had a very idyllic childhood, but her parents divorced when she was a teenager, her mom remarried, and I think something just kind of switched in her brain, whether it was puberty, mental illness, a combination of all that. She just went into this mental state and she became unwilling or unable to adapt to the situation. So in 1986, when she was 18, she left the town, left the state, and she told her mom to never look for her. Now, again, this is 1986. She's 18 years old. It's not like now where we have cell phones and the internet and GPS. We even have trouble now getting police to help with teens and adults who go missing or in cases where you need help with mental health issues. So I can imagine her mom feeling pretty damn helpless, her 18-year-old leaving and saying, just don't bother looking for me, because what option do you really have anyway? Now, we still don't know her exact whereabouts between that time in 1986 when she left and when she resurfaced in California 2 years later. What I thought was so interesting was that they did uncover that she had gotten breast implants after that legal name change from Becky Sue Turner to Lori Erica Kennedy, because the breast implants have serial numbers in them, so they were able to figure that out. They also think that she might have had a rhinoplasty at some point, but there's really no way of figuring out what doctor did that, where she stayed, what documentation she gave at that point. And it kind of leads me to the question of, do you think someone now, in 2017, almost 18, could successfully pull off identity, I want to say theft or change? I don't know. Maybe I'm just naive, but I think it would be pretty damn difficult to do that now. Now, another case that I wanted to talk about was the case of Martha Jean Lambert. If you are a native of Florida, you might know this case. And who knows, for whatever reason, you know, we just have those cases that stick out in our minds. So on November 27th, 1985, 12-year-old Martha Jean Lambert went missing near her home in St. Augustine, Florida. She was in seventh grade, and she just never came back. Body never found. They never had any suspects. They were just totally clueless. Now, it was, what they say, shrouded in mystery for 25 years until a detective took kind of a last crack at it. They went back to her neighborhood. This is wild, 25 years later. Canvassed the neighborhood and started talking to people. And then people started whispering, like, you might want to look at her brother, David. Kind of reminds you of the JonBenet case, right? So 25 years later, so David Lambert, her brother, is now in his late 30s. They go and they question him for almost 24 hours straight. Now, whether that's legal or not, I have no freaking clue. But what it comes out with is that David finally breaks. And it turns out that he and his sister Martha went to go play in some rubble. It was like a construction site where they were going to be building a college, and it had been abandoned and messing around. And apparently it was kind of a troubled family. They had been in foster care, that kind of thing. His sister Martha was asking him for money, and he was like, I just gave you money, kind of just back and forth bickering that brothers and sisters do. She slapped him or punched him, and he punched her, slapped her back, and she fell backwards. She landed on, this is according to his account, a metal spike, busted the back of her head open, just impaled her. And he panicked, so he buried her body in a shallow grave, you know, as a brother would. I mean, it's so fucked up. And he kept the secret for over 2 decades. So now it gets interesting, because the statute of limitations and all these other legal things, you know, are too complicated or they're expired. So basically, they don't charge the brother. And some of them said, like, oh, well, he clearly was troubled about it. He expressed some stress, and we'll never know if his story is true or not. And his mom says, oh, no, he was just pressured to admit to it. He didn't really do it. Although people who know him said that he's been kind of slipping here and there throughout the years. But just something about that has always stuck with me. So when I heard the JonBenet theory, I kind of just was like, no, no way. But then the more I thought about it, the more people convinced me of it. And I kind of think that, what's his name? What's his name? JonBenet's brother. Shit. Okay, I'm going to look it up. Burke. I kind of think Burke did it. Remember when that weird, creepy guy admitted to it, like in Thailand or China or something? Okay, maybe the white wine's just talking to me now. What am I talking about? All right, so after this white wine rambling, I need you guys to tell me who else can spend hours on the charlie.org site just searching through these cases thinking, this is going to be the one I'm going to solve. Am I going to recognize this face? For those of you who don't know, it's Charlie with an E-Y, so C-H-A-R-L-E-Y project.org, and they have just list and list that you can search by state of missing persons cases. And some of them are like kind of solved, but they need information. You could just spend hours on it. And maybe we need to develop our own little club, like our super sleuths. We're going to solve these cases clubs. So if there's anything else, if there's any other cases that you want to talk about, shoot them my way, because I'm all over this stuff. I've exhausted everyone else in my life talking about Dateline cases, 2020, 48 hours. Yeah, I am all about it. All right, so that wraps up my rambling of missing persons cases today. If you are interested, check out my YouTube page. The link is in the show notes. My mom and I talked on Christmas, and she just wanted to, like, tell her a little funny story. So it's all in good fun. We love each other to death. We're very close. So no worries there. Please, 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 if you could leave a written review, a 5-star review on iTunes. It really, really helps me out, helps people find the show, and I would greatly appreciate it. You guys are absolutely the best, and keep talking to me, all right? Have a wonderful rest of the week, and I'll try to pop in with some more. Talk to you guys later.